you end up in the middle of the night staying up on the phone listening to your wife give birth. What is that like?
It was very reminiscent to living in Syria, because I literally fled Syria fearing political persecution. For the Zionist lobby in this country, it's easier for them to silence the speech, to actually detain us, to smear us, than engage in a conversation. The administration doesn't care about Jewish safety, like Jewish student safety. They don't care about any student safety. What they care about is protecting Israel.
How does this change your perception of America?
Because a lot of students, they reach out to me, like, should we go to Colombia? Like, I'm accepted into Colombia. Should I go or not?
They're laying such heavy questions on you, too.
I know.
Okay, so my next guest famously became the face of the U.S. government's crackdown on pro-Palestine protests across American campuses. Mahmoud Khalil. He's the Columbia University graduate who was one of the lead negotiators during the university's Gaza Solidarity encampments, which spread what then became an international movement across campuses. So, when the U.S. government arrested and detained him earlier this year, it drew both national and international attention and widespread condemnation. You see, Mahmoud spent over 100 days in an ICE detention center in Louisiana. He even missed the birth of his first son. Well, now Mahmoud's been reunited with his wife and newborn because a federal judge released him on bail back in June. And so we're about to speak to him now to reflect and unpack together on what he saw, experienced, and endured. And he's here, Mahmoud Khalil. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on Real Talk. Let me just tell you, it's such a pleasure to have you on today.
No, thank you so much, Mohammed. Really, the pleasure is mine. I was saying, I was literally watching one of your episodes, like with Mona Chalabi, a few days ago. She's really amazing, and I'm looking forward to having this conversation with you.
Yeah, that was a great conversation. Thank you for saying that. I am super excited to be having this chat with you. Before we begin, let me just ask you, how is baby Dean doing? How is the little baby?
he's doing great. He turns 4 months in 2 days.
Bless him. That's so sweet. Mashallah.
He's a very pleasant little boy. So he sleeps 7 hours. So that's what you ask for in these early months. But it's a full time job, to have to take care of him and with Noor we're trying our best, to take care of him, be around him, and just give him the all the attention and that he needs.
And what's life like right now for you, being at home, being a dad? I mean, is it too quick to say that you've adjusted to some kind of normalcy, or is that something that's still unattainable at the moment?
No, I think it's still unattainable. So I've just moved to another apartment earlier this month, pre detainment is very different from post detainment. It's just becoming a father, but also all this pressure on me and the case. So I'm mostly spending my time between Dean and Noor and my legal team as well, and also continuing the advocacy for Palestine, because that is what really matters at this point, and they want us to be distracted from that, and which is something I refuse, and I want to continue advocating for Palestine. I'm trying between all of that. I'm behind on hundreds of messages and emails that I'm trying to catch up as much as I could.
One might ask you, Mahmoud, why not take a break? Why not take a little break and just focus on what you need to focus on, kind of get your family life in order, focus on your priorities? Why do you feel like the need that you still need to be outspoken? You still need to, avoid distractions, as you put it.
Yeah, I mean, as I always say, unfortunately, the genocide does not take a break, Mohammed. To me, it feels so difficult to remain silent and to focus on my family while I see other families being starved to death, other families being bombed, other families being ethnically cleansed. even when I look at Dean's face and while I'm feeding him, and just thinking about the hundreds of thousands of kids and children in Palestine who don't have this luxury, unfortunately. Like it's a right, you know, but for them it is a luxury to be able to eat and to find food and just to live in peace. And this is something I keep thinking about, that like, you know, like in what word I would remain silent, like for that, because this is what they tried to do. Like they tried to silence me. They wanted me to just like just focus, you know, like on my family and not care about like my people, just like as if like it's a normal life, as if everything is normal around us, which is not the case. Like I would love, you know, to just spend all my time like with my family, going back to looking for jobs or find a job and actually do that now, because I was already doing, you know, like before my arrest I had a job lined up like to start at the beginning of April.
Was it Oxfam?
It was at Oxfam International, right. So the position was Palestine and Middle East policy advisor at their office at the United Nations here in New York. So I was already like doing, you know, like advocacy for Palestine as part of my job. So and now this did not change. So I'm continuing to do that in different capacities. But the goal is one is to achieve Palestinian liberation, to shed light on Palestinian the Palestinian struggle.
And Mahmoud, speaking about the UN and Oxfam and kind of just your career trajectory, you wanted to be a diplomat. You wanted to pursue a career in diplomacy. Is that correct?
Yeah, I wanted to be honest, like to have Palestinian voices heard, especially on international platforms where you can see that our voices are being attacked, are being silenced at such platforms, and having others talk about Palestinians, talk what Palestinians are and what they want. So I wanted to have this position where I can actually speak for my people, speak about them and actually advocate on their behalf. And you know, I'm since I was young, like I'm very calm. I would always like prefer dialogue, conversations.
We're gonna really delve into your calm demeanor as the conversation goes. But can I actually, here's a point that I wanna ask you about. After everything that's happened to you, and also in light of what's happening on the ground, the genocide in Gaza, when you say something like, I wanted Palestinian voices to be heard and I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to take that path, a lot of people that I've spoken to, whether in the diplomatic sense, whether in journalism in our industry, they've become quite disillusioned about this whole idea of fixing something from the inside. You know, I'm going to go in and I'm going to try to fix the system from the inside, because if they hear my voice, if they see my face, someone somewhere is going to change. Now, has your perception changed from that moment where you decided to pursue that career till today?
Since always, I felt that diplomacy is just actually reflecting what's happening on the ground and translate it into that like fancy words and actually having these dialogue. But like, as in itself, it's not a solution. As in itself, it's not something that you should only pursue like this track. It's one of many, you know, like as in everything. But I felt that I can have a better role in diplomacy in this position than like anything else, like whether organizing on the ground, other forms of resistance and other forms of just, you know, advocacy. But you're totally right. Like, you would be disillusioned if you think just by talking you would be able to achieve something significant. And it's clear, like with what happened with Palestine. You know, we did not lose Palestine over a debate. We did not lose Palestine over just a conversation. No, there was actual occupation on the ground. There were like all these things happening, and diplomacy was part of it. Like, also we would be disillusioned if we think that the Zionist movement did not succeed because of their also diplomatic power going back to the like 1890s, like when the first Zionist Congress, where they focused a lot on advocacy and focused a lot on lobbying across European countries and later in the United States. So it's one component of it. But like, to be blindsided and think that this is the way, no, it's totally wrong. It's just like one important component out of the full picture that we shouldn't disregard, because it matters, and we need to have our voices heard. And that's why for so long Israel deliberately and systematically silenced Palestinian voices. They did not want the world to hear from Palestinians, to hear their stories, to hear their vision for the future, because they painted that specific picture about what a Palestinian is, what a Palestinian would do, and they literally manufactured, our killing based on that narrative that we should.
You talked about it before, this narrative about being a perfect victim.
Yeah, exactly. So the narrative, I say from their point of view, their narrative about the Palestinian being violent, the Palestinian being inherently anti-Semitic, the Palestinian being inherently violent, and then that goes toward the narrative where if the world is expecting the Palestinians to be perfect victims, like despite the endless pains and struggles that a Palestinian would face on a daily basis, they're still expecting you to just die in front of the camera, to just like mourn your children in front of the camera without actually fighting back, without actually saying that you exist. So that's the narrative of unfortunately that now is being played on Western media.
Do you think with everything that happened to you, you in a way became a perfect victim? Would you accept that label?
I wouldn't say like I'm, there's a lot of like lies about me online. There's a lot of that, but I usually don't like to talk about the conflict in a victim, like victimization.
Sure.
Like,
side, no, I understand side, that. Side,
right? Like we have agency. Like, as Palestinians, we have agency, and we want to have this agency, and we want to show the world that we have agency. Because the whole world is trying to decide our future, decide what we should do, what we shouldn't do. We need to have agency that, like, actually. But I'm of course like a victim of this disinformation, of this racism, supremacy that really, like, all these lies that spread about me, like the day of my arrest, like no one knew anything about me before. And then despite not having any sort of evidence to back their claims, I became that victim. But since ever, I believed in Palestinian human rights. I believed in our right to decide our future, our right in self-determination. And I did everything in my capacity to achieve that.
During your time at Columbia, even before October 7th, I heard you say something along the lines of that there was, you felt even from before that time that there was anti-Palestinian sentiment on campus.
Can
you expand on that?
That surprised me, to be honest, Mohammed. So when I joined in, January 2023, and I wanted to be, you know, part of Middle Eastern clubs, like the clubs that I care about, like debate club, such you know, clubs. And I joined the Palestine Working Group at SIPA, Colombia, my specific school. And we wanted, one of the first events we wanted to host was invite Omar Shaker.
From BDS.
From
Human Rights Watch. Yes, Omar Shaker from Human Rights Watch.
He's the Israel Palestine director Human Rights Watch to talk about international law in Israel Palestine. So we submit this event, and then we receive a notification that your event has been designated as a special event, and you need to go through this like very lengthy process with the administration to make it happen. And at the same time, I was part of like other groups, so I can't see how events happen. Like you literally just like submit it online, then you receive confirmation like momentarily, like within an hour or so. So we went and asked like why this event was flagged as a special event. And then they were like, oh, because it is about Palestine, it is a controversial topic, we need to review and vet like the speaker, the topics, and all of that, and that to me was like I was at SIPA, the School of Public and International Affairs, so this is the usual type of speakers that you would bring to such a school. We had that long like back and forth with the administration. We made it happen. They brought security. They sent like a delegate to be there. So you can sense that double standard in dealing with us and that like scrutiny. But then after that, we invited someone from BDS, Mahmoud Nawaja, the national coordinator of BDS. And he was joining online, like on Zoom.
Okay.
Yet the event was also flagged as a special event because of the same.
Were you being given reasons at the time, Mahmoud? Were you being given that, no, this is because it relates to Israel?
They were like, yeah, because it's a controversial topic, like it's about Palestine, blah, blah, blah. Although at that time, I still remember like a group invited an Israeli, and it was not one group, like another group at SIPA, and it was not flagged as a special event. One time they invited a former president to SIPA, and also it was not flagged as a special event. So it was like very clear that there is some sort of like a red line on Palestine related events, and that continued. Like, I mean, it became more obvious, more apparent after October 7.
Right.
But even before then, like at that time when we decided to create, I founded with someone else, I founded like the Palestine Student Union, Dar, home in Arabic, just to, you know, like to deal with such discrimination against Palestinians. We wanted to have that one social or one society for all Palestinians to gather under.
What's a case that's memorable to you from that experience, from that group?
You mean, if you can say that again?
So you're saying you created that group, right? Or you mm-hmm. helped create it. Is there a specific case that kind of sticks to you about discrimination against Palestinians that you kind of intervened or dealt with?
I mean, it's all over the place. Like Colombia is dealing, like, you know, and when after October 7,
this group was after October 7th or was it before?
No, it was like we created it like
before,
through the summer,
right?
And then in September, like we started like events. But other than the examples I've already mentioned about discrimination, it's just like the fact that you always feel that they are dealing with a risk when they are talking to you or when you are discussing any event with them. They are always in this containment mode, like, oh, how can we make your event more contained, like not a lot of people would hear about it, but also like to control it as much as possible. So we needed to have, like, over the summer a lot of meetings with Columbia administrators, just like to make the case that we want to create the society. And I remember, like, because usually when you want to create a new club at Columbia, like, the students have to vote on it. And the first time, they did not present it to the students in the town hall. So that was, like, you know, one example of them trying to silence us or contain us. And the examples after October 7th are endless. Right. I think I talked about that.
Yeah.
But quite often.
Before we even get into any of that, how did you become a face of these protests, the face that we all know now? How did you become having a leading role in the protests that were happening on campus post October 7th?
So, I mean, that's connected to my answer of creating DAR.
Okay.
So as I told you, like, during the summer and then, like, at the beginning of the fall, I would have these long conversations with the administrators about the club, about creating the club. So I already established that relationship with the administrators. And then after October 7, I continued that role of being... Of just being like the communicator between the students and the administration, because the students did not trust the administration at all. Mm-hmm. They did not want to deal with the administration, because you have an administration that 24/7 pushing a very dangerous narrative, a very Zionist narrative, and the students did not feel comfortable actually working with them. But also I understood the importance of actually having this channel open between the students and the administration, just like first to communicate their concerns, their demands to the administration. And second, just to coordinate, to make sure everyone's safe when there's protests, when there's all of that. And then during the encampment, as a continuation of that role, the students and faculty asked me to represent, like, the encampment in the negotiation with the administration. So that was, like, the first public facing role I ever took.
And your wife Noor says that you became the negotiator also because of your calm demeanor, which we touched on.
Yeah, I mean, the students wanted, you know, like, and the faculty wanted, like, someone who would actually, like, go and have a dialogue rather than, like, you know, fight and
sure
in the room. And
but is this demeanor, Mahmoud, is it because that you feel like you're representing something that's bigger than yourself? That is, this is something that extends.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, like, I'm that small, very small fish in a huge ocean. And it's absolutely way beyond me. But I mean, my calm demeanor, like, goes back to when I was young. So I don't know what.
It's just exactly. Who you are.
Yeah, it's just like who I am, and I'm that calm, but. But also because the stakes are very high, so you have to be very calculated, and to actually be principled, and this is why the students trusted me with that. Like, they knew that you know, I represent, like, or they can trust me with representing Palestine there. They can trust that I have the necessary skills to actually go and negotiate with the administrators, and similarly with the faculty. But also, like, you know, like, a lot of these students were undergrads, like, between 18 to 21. At that time I was like 28 or 29, so also, like, this had, like, you know, I had 10 years experience working like in
did they see you as an older brother figure or like a father or older exactly, brother? I wouldn't exactly, say father like figure, that. But like older brother figure.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, like that. Yeah, absolutely. Like just like an older person who they can trust who can represent as many voices as possible.
Mm. And when you were dealing with the administrators, Mahmoud, and when you were engaged in these conversations, is there a particular scene or a particular convo that you had that maybe shocked you or surprised you in terms of what the administrators were telling you?
There's quite a lot. The first thing, I think it was the first or the second negotiation meeting we had, like, I felt that they're not taking us seriously. And they're dealing like with kids
being dismissive,
being very dismissive, being like very, patriarchal, you know, like right. that they know better. And
right.
I remember from the first meeting, like I looked at him and I told him, like, I look to you eye to eye, like, you're not better than me. Don't think that you're an administrator. That means like you have more, seniority over me. We're here equal, and you have to treat me equally. And I remember, like in that meeting or the second one, I left the room because I felt they were not taking. Yeah, I walked out, and I did not feel that they were taking us seriously. And the second time when they threatened me, like they gave me sort of like an offer, and they told me it was I think around like 7-8 p.m. And they told me, you have until 12. If you don't sign it, the police or the National Guard will come to campus. And they felt it was a bluff. So I also, like, I told them, like, okay, like, bring them. And they left. An hour later, they were calling me, begging me, like, to come back. But there were, like, a lot of these conditions. Like, I had with me another co-negotiator who was brilliant, too. She helped a lot with everything and led a lot of the process with that. But you know, it was a very difficult job because 2-3 days into the negotiation, you open the New York Times and there's like a whole tab about negotiations at Columbia. So it felt like all that pressure that everyone is actually watching what's happening, and there are like hundreds of students in the encampment that I need to report back to, because this is another thing, like, people don't really understand. They think that like there's a leadership and, you know, you go to the leaders and, you know, but no, it was like you go to the whole encampment. You have a daily town hall or assembly. And then in the assembly, I would report back what happened in the negotiation room. These are our options. This is what they offered. And then people would comment, then would vote, and then I would go back with their vote to the negotiation room. So it was difficult, like both sides, you know, like it's not only like I'm someone who can actually decide and like do whatever
I get that sense. Was Manoush Shafiq at these talks that you were engaged?
No, she was. We refused to meet with her. So that was one of the things. Like the first session of negotiation, they offered like that Manoush would come and meet with us, and then I went back to the students. This is what was offered. Then everyone, I mean, the vote was to reject the offer because we felt that she want to use it like for optics, not to actually like negotiate or actually give anything to the students, and we refused that, and we rather that we continue negotiations with these senior administrators in her office.
And then from that point, things started developing quite quickly,
it was very, very obvious that Colombia was just buying time. They did not know what they are doing. You know, like usually when you go into negotiation, you have a certain position, and I felt that they did not have any position. They were there just like to buy time to make the illusion, like, to the public that that we are in dialogue with the students, that we are negotiating with the students, that we want to solve the issue. But at no point it felt that they were serious about actually meeting our demands. And it was very obvious, like, they did not want to make any, every time we mentioned something about, like, anything critical of Israel, they would immediately deflect or, like, offer something that is not, that's not, like, critical of Israel. So it was very obvious that this was what they were doing, and the students got very frustrated by that, which led to escalations. And this is the way that Colombia dealt with the student movement as a whole at Colombia. You know, the students since 2002, like, it's not recent. The first referendum at Colombia to boycott Israel was in 2002. Yet Colombia always refused to discuss the matter, and there's a famous quote by Colombia's former president Lee Bollinger, who said the subject of divestment from Israel is not something that we will discuss at Colombia, because the students every year every other
from the
encampment.
Yeah.
So and the students every year every other year would pass a referendum, like an overwhelmingly number of students, like, would vote against the against, like, collaboration with Israel, divestment from companies complicit in the Israeli occupation, and Colombia refused or totally ignored any of that. And then after October 7, every week you would have a huge protest at Colombia asking, like, you know, like, for Colombia to denounce the killing, to at least, like, not push that Zionist narrative on campus, and to just, like, acknowledge the Palestinian pain. Yet they refused. So the students felt that they needed to escalate to do the encampment. After the encampment, it was the first time that Colombia actually, like, meet with representative from the students, with negotiators. And it was the same. It was, like, obvious that they were just buying time. They're not negotiating in good faith. And then the students, some students felt they needed to escalate, and they took the decision to occupy Hinds Hall.
Right. And a lot happened that night as well, mm-hmm. when the police came in. But I want to, you know, because you were talking about how young a lot of these students were, 18, 19, 20. I want to talk about the repercussions that a lot of these students ended up facing. I mean, what, Colombia expelled 80 students, I think, if I remember. And the thing is, when you're this young and you go into an academic institution and you see something like what's happening in Gaza today, obviously you're moved by it. You feel like you're in a space where you can kind of raise your voice, you can protest, you can do something that would maybe lead to some sort of change. And then after everything that's happened at Columbia, and especially the fact that, you know, when you're young, again, you kind of have the space where, especially at a university, you're allowed to make mistakes. You're allowed to make decisions that hopefully won't impact the rest of your life. And yet the repercussions were quite severe on a lot of these students. I'm not even talking about the ones that were targeted by the government or targeted by ICE. I'm talking about the repercussions academically, facing expulsion and other procedures. How did you see the impact on the students when the repercussions were coming to the surface?
These students are so brave, Muhammad. Like, I really get, like, so, like, very inspired by them, because I remember when I was 18, 19 years old, you know, and for them, they are dealing with so much, like, violence and life-changing decisions, But they refuse to remain silent in the face of genocide, that they are witnessing genocide in the face of this repression. And Colombia employed similar tactics to what Israel is employing in Palestine, and then on a I would say like a smaller scale. But if Colombia had the power to detain me, they would have done that. Like they, you know,
you think so? You think Colombia would have detained you?
Absolutely. I mean, because now they are arresting students, so they gave. Just recently, they gave their public safety the authority to arrest students. So they're literally like employing.
This is part of the deal with the Trump administration, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they started it like a few months before, but it's being painted as part of the whole package. But also they literally had checkpoints on campus. Surveillance was scary across the university. They would literally bring like leaflets to distribute to the students to disperse, you know, similar to the tactics of Israel when they used to throw them from their airplanes, that if you don't leave this area by 1 hour, then you'll be killed. At Colombia, it was like, if you don't leave this area in 1 hour, you will be disciplined and you'll be expelled.
Why do you feel like you need to draw that comparison, though, between the Colombia administration and what the Israeli?
Because the whole thing it's felt like very, very similar, same tactics, same authoritarian tactics, that they want to silence you. They don't want you to exist on this campus. A lot of the board in Colombia, like, they're very staunchly Zionists. Some of them actually are on boards of companies like Lockheed Martin, weapon manufacturers that benefit from the genocide in Gaza. The security tactics, like when they have a lot of like their staff were former NYPD staff who were trained in Israel. The system was very, very similar, like the system of suppression and oppression at Colombia. And these students, just to go back to the repercussions that these students had to face, it's immense. Like, the police came to campus more than five times in about a year. And the last time the police entered Colombia was in 1960 something.
Right, during the Vietnam War.
Exactly. So yeah. It was like 53 years ago or 55 years ago that the police entered Colombia, and Colombia made a decision to not ever invite the police on campus. Yet when it was about Palestine, they brought the police five times. Then they deputized their own public safety to arrest the students. So these students faced immense violence, institutional violence. Just to shut up, like, we don't want you to talk about Palestine. And this is one of the things that is not really being reported about, or there isn't like that outrage. Unfortunately, like, over 100 students at Colombia have been either suspended or expelled. So it's not only the 80. The 80 students actually were suspended. I mean, part of them suspended for a number of years, another expelled. For protesting my detention. They were part of an action that demanded my release. They demanded that Colombia should say something about my detention. And Colombia responded by expelling them and suspending them. As you said, like, these are life-changing decisions that now against them. Like, when I talk to a lot of these students, none of them is regretting it, because they know that the price of remaining silent, the price of normalizing the killing, the genocide, is much higher than actually being suspended or being expelled, or in my case, being deported.
Mm-hmm. Let me before we actually speak about that, let me go back on this this package, as you put it, with the Columbia University accepted with the Trump government. First off, I want to talk this in light of I guess Columbia's reputation right now. There's a few things I want to ask you about. It's the reputation, but it's also the stipulations that come with this deal that they made with the Trump government. One of them is adopting the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. But another is also the what it means to have academic receivership for the Middle East department, the Middle East Studies department. And I guess the reason why I ask that is what comes to mind. I'm like, okay, so obviously right now it seems like almost impossible to protest and speak up for Gaza on campus after everything that's happened. But it also seems like this is going to affect academic debate, academic expression, the fact that you can actually speak about Israel-Palestine freely as a student. So how does that strike you?
You know, like what my case and just the Columbia case made it very obvious is that for the Zionist lobby in this country, it's easier for them to silence the speech, to actually detain us, to smear us, than engage in a conversation, like to engage in academia, like in academic freedom, because they know they don't have an argument, and the fact that they are going after the Middle East institute at Columbia, or MISAS, the Middle East, and then South Asia, I believe. Because they wanted to police thought, like that's what the administration wanted. The administration doesn't care about Jewish safety, like Jewish student safety. They don't care about any student safety. What they care about is protecting Israel, shielding Israel from any sort of criticism, whether in the academic sphere or in student circles, and to police thought about any. What they call like liberal thoughts, you know, like that's what, because the first thing that they say, oh, we need to protect Jewish students, but then adapt IHRA, which doesn't have anything to do with protecting students. It's just literally shielding Israel. But then it goes into ending the DEI diversity and equity and programs at Columbia. And then goes into, you know, like just like policing everything and requesting certain faculty and all of that. And Columbia, like it was disgusting that they literally capitulated to this administration fully, like without any sort of pushback against that. And this would haunt them toward the end. But this is what Columbia about. Like Columbia cares about its profit, cares about its the Board of Trustees ideology. So because they act as if they own Columbia University, they act as if Columbia is it's their own property, and they know that like that the moment that students and faculty and Columbia as an institution divested from Israel, there will be a domino effect across U.S. universities, across the world. So they want to.
You think that's why they're holding on? You think that's why?
Yeah, absolutely. Because they know that, like, the moment that Columbia actually divests from Israel, all other universities around the United States would follow suit. The same with the like when the students at Columbia like started the encampment. You saw like hundreds of universities across the world also establishing their own encampments, and that's what they're trying to do, because for them just the symbolism of Columbia listening to their students would create a national, if not international, ripple effect ripple effect again, like for against Israel.
I want to ask you about the legacy of these protests, about these encampments, how you've been reflecting on it. Because as you're talking, I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, okay, what if I was a young international student that just got accepted to Columbia, and I care deeply about what's happening in the world, but I also care deeply about my career, my degree, my future. So seeing everything that's happened to you, seeing everything that's happened to others, seeing how the university reacted to those who participated in protest, obviously I would be, as that student, I would be quite scared. It would make me think twice, to say the least. So what are your reflections in that part in terms of legacy, but also in terms of discouraging others from repeating what's happened?
Yeah. To be honest, like I still have like my own thoughts about, like, I'm still like processing, also struggling with that, because, you know, like what Colombia wants is not to have any students who cares about human rights, who cares about Palestinian rights, who cares about just the issues that they disagree with. They want it to have that very homogeneous environment where students would just go to classes. They may protest about climate change. They may protest about like prison funding, but not about like these critical. Not to say that like climate change and that not critical, but not about like these like, you know, international controversial like matters. I would say that's why like my first instinct would be, no, I want students to continue to go to Colombia, so they can call them out, so they can, because Colombia is not, it's not the Board of Trustees property, but the word, as I said, like the Board of Trustees wants to, or they are acting as if it is their property. They wanted like not to have any opposition, and believe me, Muhammad, like our existence is in itself an issue for them. Like just the existence of a Palestinian student or a pro-Palestine students on campus is an issue for the university.
Mahmoud? You really think it's to
absolutely
that extent?
Yeah,
I'm not downplaying what you're saying, but it's just, to me, to hear that, you know, the fact that you can go to university anywhere in America or other places in the West, and the board sees you as a threat because of a cause that you've aligned yourself with. It's still heavy to hear.
The fact that the university went after students for wearing kufiyas, did nothing. We're walking on campus for wearing kufiyas, and they were reported to be anti-Semite. Students who asked a question in a class about Palestine, like it was in a very academic setting, they asked a question about Palestine. They were reported to the university that they were anti-Semite, and the university actually investigated them on why you asked such a question. Makes you think, yes, like it is our existence on such campus that is a problem for them. And just like 2 days ago, when I think the New York Post reported that it's an insane title about like Gaza Deli, like a supermarket called Gaza, and they saying that,
oh, yes,
this,
it was about
this
safety.
Is making,
I saw that headline. I think it was in the New York.
Yeah,
Post
in Brooklyn, like exactly, like it's in Brooklyn, like a deli called Gaza, and
the New York
Zionist
Post, I think
that
covered it in the sense of like it made individuals feel unsafe.
Unsafe, and
because it had Gaza.
So that. Yeah, and that makes you, you know, that makes my argument is real, that like our whole existence is an issue for them, and that's what they are doing in Palestine. They want to just like erase us and erase any reference to Palestine, the same way that they're doing now in Colombia is doing in their curriculum. With you know, the receivership on the Middle East Institute, I believe they also instructed their professors to review their syllabus on issues regarding to Palestine and Israel. So they wanted to erase any reference to us, like gradually, you know, like it started with the IHRA, but it will go on and on and on, like to actually erase any mention about Palestine. That's why I'm struggling with this question about, because a lot of students, they reach out to me like, should we go to Colombia? Like, I'm accepted into Colombia. Should I go or not? And most of the time, my answer is, yeah, go. Like, you have to go there and challenge their narrative.
So they're laying such heavy questions on you too.
I mean,
coming to you after everything you've been through, and they're like, hey man, should I go? What do you think?
Because I knew from the beginning that that was their whole problem, like just like the existence of Palestinians and the existence of our voices on campus.
So does this make academic freedom bullshit then? Is it all just a mirage?
It is. As long as it is convenient for them, they love it. You know, they would go and talk about it and celebrate it. But the moment that it actually challenges their narrative and their ideology, they would come as hard as possible against you, the same way that they did with me with freedom of speech. You know, like that. America, the United States, and in general, they you know, they celebrate freedom of speech. They have like this very high bar for freedom of speech. But the moment it is about Palestine, everything is shattered, and this is what we call the Palestine exception in this country. Everything stops at Palestine. Everything in this country, like that goes like, you know, the institutions, whether they're academic, economic, any institution, when it comes to Palestine, there is always an exception. And that what made Colombia administration very uncomfortable, because we would show them, like, you know, like when October 7 happened, in a matter of in that week, we received countless emails from the president, from the vice president, from the deans of schools, from, you know, the alumni association, from everyone, like pushing Israel like narrative to us. And then when we go and we told them, like, just 6 months ago, over 50,000 Syrians and Turkish people died in the earthquake, and we did not receive a word from you. But if you want to say that was like a natural disaster, okay. But like a few weeks ago, in, I think it was in Congo or Sudan, also like thousands of people were killed, and we did not hear a word from you. Why now you felt the urgency to actually say something from the president of it? They didn't have an answer for that. And it was obvious their hypocrisy and their double standards when it comes to Palestine. And then they suggested something called academic
neutrality.
So they suggested that
maybe
neutrality. Yeah. That's the word. So they suggested academic neutrality because they said, okay, like you made a good point. So now we don't want to comment about anything like happening around the world. And we told them, okay, like now that it's about Palestine, you don't want to do it. But when it was about Israel, we were happily doing it. So there's this double standard. It's not even, I mean, it's across the West. Like but it's so obvious, like in the US, the Palestine exception.
When you started feeling unsafe, you obviously, as you said, you were subjected to a major smear campaign online. You had individuals linked to Colombia tweeting about you. You had organizations tweeting about you. All sorts of things. And very much trying to assassinate your character, very much trying to smear you, trying to link you to criminal activity. But before I even get into that, are you surprised at all by how the administration or officials from the U.S. government talk about how they take information from organizations like Canary Mission and Bitar? Like, does that come to you as a surprise that the government itself takes information from these groups?
Absolutely. Like, it's very concerning that now the like Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian bigotry is becoming institutionalized in the U.S. government, because I've been doxxed like since the encampment, like since April 2024. You know, New York Post and others, like they smeared me and doxxed me. But I did not care because I knew they use this as intimidation. They don't want employers to offer you a job, all of that. But the moment that you had this collaboration between the government and these racist and supremacist and shady groups, like they're so shady, like, you know, like Canary Mission and Betar, you don't know who's running them. That when it became extremely dangerous, because these groups, they literally, like, if you wear a kufiya, they would dox you, like not to say any statement. And that was very obvious, like when the federal judge here, like, said that there's no evidence that Mahmoud said any of that. There's no evidence that he did any of what you're saying. The administration actually, like, did not care.
You're talking about the federal judge.
Yeah, the federal judge.
Yeah,
in New York.
Well, that's isn't that why they referred? I'm talking about the government. Isn't that why they ultimately referred to that what's it called, the Immigration Act?
The one from 1952.
The 1952 one, because first of all, they couldn't provide any tangible evidence linking you to all these allegations that they were making. So they basically had to refer to the McCarran Act of 1952, which had a line about the Secretary of State could basically deport you or deport an individual because of if they have any, to have any adverse effect on.
U.S. foreign
policy. Yeah, exactly. Go ahead.
No. I mean, it's just want to say that it's just to me, like, it's bizarre that they had to go back to 1952 to find a reason.
And it's a very obscure provision as well.
Very. I mean, that's what the federal judge found, that, like, it's very ambiguous, like you can't do that, because, and also it was the first time in U.S. history they implemented against someone like me, like a green card holder who only engage in First Amendment or in free speech activities, because the secretary, like Rubio, the Secretary of State himself, he concedes in his determination that my, like he said, like my activities, associations, blah blah blah, otherwise lawful. Like he says, like otherwise lawful, they present like adverse foreign policy threat to the United States. So he literally like concedes that like everything I was engaged in was lawful or allegedly involved in, and then like it was used against the Shah of Iran. Back in the 70s or the 80s, when that created, you know, like foreign policy, actually a foreign policy threat to the United States, like for their staff in Tehran. Then they used it against like a Mexican attorney general who was indicted of money laundering. But then to use it against someone who literally did nothing, and they used,
and that what's crazy about that act itself, the McCarran-Walter Act of 1952, is that historically, first of all, one of the senators that co-signed it, McCarran, he was known to be an anti-Semite, right? He was extremely anti-Semitic. Yes.
And that specific provision, the 1952, it was used actually to prevent Jewish immigrants from coming to the United States.
Yes, Eastern European Jews, exactly. Yeah,
exactly. Like it was the same one, and now they're using it in this way against like Palestinian activism in this country. And just to show you that, like, they really don't care about anti-Semitism. They don't care about any of that. They only care about protecting Israel and about like fighting dissent in this country. And to make an example out of me, so others would be deterred from talking about Palestine, from speaking out, from opposing this government. I believe the whole thing is literally about this.
When you started, and we've seen the email that you had sent right before you were taken in, this is like, I think, 2 days before, where you had sent to the interim president of Columbia, basically saying that you felt unsafe, that you're being doxxed, that you need the university to kind of intervene. And you hadn't heard a reply, or they hadn't intervened. They didn't take any action in that regard. And then 2 days later, these plainclothes officers show up to your home. We again also saw the viral video that your wife Noor took of you kind of being handcuffed and taken away. You know, Noor ends that video saying "Kif fini attasil fik," which means how can I contact you? But all of this, how do you even look back at all of this, Mahmoud? I mean, is it a blur? Is it very clear? Because there was a lot happening. Your wife was 8 months pregnant. First of all, it was Ramadan as well. You had just come back from an iftar. You're being taken in after being told that your visa was revoked, even though that you have a green card. There's a lot happening in that moment. How do you even remember it? How do you look back at it?
Scariest night in my life. You know, I lived through like the Syrian revolution. I went to Lebanon. I witnessed the Beirut explosion in 2020. So I went through very difficult like times in my life. Yeah, like that night was one of the scariest in my life. Mostly I was worried about Noor, to be honest, because they threatened to arrest her. And as you said, like then she was eight months pregnant. And we don't have any family in New York. So it was very scary, because the last thing I heard that like, if you don't leave him, we will arrest you. And then they put me in the car. And it's to me, it's just like a stain on US, on the US rule of law, that you had, as you said, plainclothes agents coming without an arrest warrant, without any cause, like to arrest someone who never engaged in anything unlawful. They did not have as you said, like the first thing they told me, your visa has been revoked. But then it was like, I don't have a visa. Like, what you're talking about? And I can see them like very looking very confused when I told them like I'm actually a lawful permanent resident in this country. And then, yeah, someone on the phone like said, yeah, bring him anyways, you know. And in this country, you learn that, like, you know, like the first thing you should ask is the arrest warrant, like show me that you have an arrest warrant. And they broke into a private property like that my building is owned by Colombia. And they broke into it without also without any warrant to do so. So they did all these illegal things to get me in a country that supposedly respects due process and rule of law, and to see that, you know, being shattered in 5 minutes, like they did not care about anything. Then for the next 30 hours, they refused to let me like call my lawyer, take me from one place to another, and like in a matter of 30 hours, like I was in Louisiana. Like it would have been easier to fly from New York to London actually than from New York to Louisiana, just to take me to a place where they think they can control the legal outcome of my case, to a place that's favorable to the Republicans. It's just like insane that this can happen in this country.
Here's the thing, Mahmoud, to even add to what you were saying just now. So I grew up on the East Coast of Canada. But you know, I didn't grow up in the Middle East. My family's from Egypt. You obviously grow up from movies, from popular culture, from stories. You hear about how in a lot of, you know, countries in the region, you kind of keep quiet. You try not to upset authorities because you're always under, especially in countries like Syria, where you grew up, you're under, there's always the shadow of the mukhabarat, the shadow of the intelligence agencies that just hover above you. And hearing you describe everything that you just went through, it almost like if you hadn't said this was in the United States, I think the first person's guess would have been like, oh, did this happen to you in Syria under Assad? I think someone would have probably tried to guess.
No, absolutely. That was my whole reaction. Like, it was very reminiscent to living in Syria, because I literally fled Syria fearing political prosecution after Assad the Assad regime kidnapped two of my friends. I had to leave the next day to Lebanon, fearing that I would be disappeared or arbitrarily detained for my political beliefs, and to come to a country that champions freedom of speech. So it's absolutely the same, because you describe it very well. In our countries, unfortunately, in Syria, it was the case. Unfortunately, it seems it's still. You have plainclothes agents coming without any papers, anything, and they literally kidnap you from the street or from your home. And I lived through it. Having lived in Syria for 18 years, I see this around me all the time. And always you have the United States championing democracy and rule of law, and then all that shatters because I said something that the those in power did not like.
And how does this change your perception of America?
Growing up, we were always, you see that the negative impact of America's foreign policy on us, especially when it comes to Palestine. But at no point I felt that the system is weak on the inside. Despite everything, I always believed that America has a robust democracy, at least when it comes to freedom of speech. I always had my reservation to the Palestine exception. I always knew that. And now it just reinforced my belief of the Palestine exception in this country, that it goes well beyond the media and academic institutions. It goes very well into also the legal system and the executive branch as a whole, that they are willing to change and bring laws just to come after you.
And you said that it was 30 hours before you got to Louisiana. It was New York, New Jersey, and I think it was Texas, or is it New York, New Jersey, back to JFK, and then Texas, and then from Texas to Louisiana. At one point, you said that there was an officer that was Googling you during this trip.
Yeah,
he was Googling. So, what's your reaction as you're sitting in the back, seeing this guy pull out his phone, being like, "Okay, who's this person? What did he do?"
Yeah. So I mean, at that point, I was totally in the dark. They wouldn't, as I said, wouldn't let me call anyone, wouldn't let me see the news, nothing. I was by myself all the time, from one officer to another. And then because I spent about 12 hours with the same two officers that they were taking me from JFK to Louisiana, and they asked them questions about my family, do you know anything? They were oh, we don't know, we're here just to transport you. And then I can see one of them reading a full article about me, and at that point I what's happening, I mostly feared about Noor's health, what if something happened that made the news, when you don't know anything, it's a very it's a very difficult like feeling that, because I didn't know like anything, like, you know, a day later, Noor, like 2 days, I mean, on Monday morning, Noor told me that like, oh, Rubio talked about me. Trump also talked about me. Right, the White House the tweeted about me.
Shalom Mahmoud.
Exactly. And all that happened while like I had no idea that this is happening. So to the point that when I arrived in the detention center, everyone knew me there, and I did not like, you know, like I did not know that like, oh, this, the news actually like made it to front pages and to every outlet in this country.
And then what happens when you get to Louisiana? You spent what, 104 days there. What kind of conditions were you in? You said you were put in a cell with 70 people. Is that true? Mm-hmm. Or an area with 70 people?
So I did not know. I did not know where I was going at that point. Sure. Like, they wouldn't tell me. Like, I was.
Did you ever think, by the way, Mahmoud, did you ever think that deportation was real? Did you ever feel like deportation was imminent?
Yeah, I mean, when I was being transported from New Jersey to JFK, I felt that I was actually going to be deported. Like, I'm going to JFK to catch a flight, like to Syria or Algeria.
Right. Because you hold Algerian citizenship.
Exactly. I have an Algerian nationality from my mother. So it felt very real. And I only knew that I was going to Louisiana when I was boarding the flight. That I read that it's going to Texas, and then the officer told me, yeah, like, we're going to Texas, then we're going to Louisiana. When we arrived in the facility, like, I also didn't know that what an ICE detention is. Like, I had no idea. You know, I've been in this country for 2 years at that point, so I don't know what an ICE detention is. So we arrived there around like 1 a.m. in the morning, and then the next, like, I entered this huge like facility, and I entered in this cell or dorm. A lot of people there. It was like already 1 something, so everyone was asleep. A few people came, like, you know, welcomed me, and then I started like to, you know, like to realize that, oh, it is a detention for immigrants, because two of the people who were helping me, like setting up my bunk, they did not speak any English. So then I was like, okay, like that's a detention center for immigrants. And then we enter there, but like since the moment I was arrested, like, you were expected to just like follow orders. Like, they wouldn't tell you where they're taking you. Like, they're just like, come with us, you know? And then I was shackled for most of the time. And that felt like very dehumanizing, that, you know, like being shackled, your ankles and your hands, you feel like you're doing something like really, really scary.
Is there ever a conversation about rights in that center?
No, that's one of the main thing, because the first day I was there, they give you like a small booklet, like about the facility, what this facility is about, like what you can ask for and all of that. So I read it, but then I go there and none of the things described in this booklet actually happening.
So what are you going to do with a booklet? You're shackled.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I mean, when you're inside, like, you can read it, but like, then you're like, no, I mean, during the 30 hours, nothing. Like, they don't even say who they are. Like, nothing whatsoever. Like, it felt like kidnapping 100%. You're taken from one car to another, all of them civilian cars or unmarked cars. So you wouldn't know like where you're going, anything. Like, they did not even read me my rights during the arrest, or during like when they gave me the charges, they did not read them to me, anything. So I'm saying, like, when you arrive in the detention center, like, sure, in Louisiana,
yeah.
And there I had the booklet, like, about what what the rights are. And I mean, when it was March, so it was very cold. They give you like this very thin blanket. You have a very hard mattress, no pillow. It was Ramadan, as you mentioned. Yeah. So, I mean, for the next, I think like 5 days, I really did not eat like anything. Like I tried eating once, I threw up. The meat felt like mud, like it did not feel like meat, or taste, sorry, like meat. So I switched to vegetarian, but then with the vegetarian, you only get beans, like white beans, black beans, red eye beans, like, you know, every day a different color of beans. But the scary thing is just like the people there, where they were very devastated. They didn't know like what they can do. Are they going to be deported? Not going to be deported? A lot of them were picked up from their court hearings, from their ICE check-ins, from the immigration check-ins, or from their work. And they're being portrayed as violent, as criminals on the media, because that's all what Trump and his cabinet talk about is just like, we are detaining and deporting criminals. But a lot of these people are just like, you know, family members, like family men. They have like US family members too. They were in the process of gaining documentation or documents in this country. Right. So the scary part was like they don't know anything. They don't know what their rights are. They literally have no idea. So I was in that, like, I was privileged, like, to know, to actually, like, you know a little bit about, like, bureaucracy. And then, like, 2-3 days after, I talked to my lawyers. They explained a lot of things to me, and went back, like, explained things to them as well. So,
Mahmoud, so during that time, you're telling me about being in detention, speaking to the other detainees around you, and then your wife gives birth to Dean, and he's your firstborn, right? First child, and you're not there. I think you had requested a temporary release and it was rejected, and you end up in the middle of the night staying up on the phone listening to your wife give birth. In a room or cell with 70 people as you were, what is that like? I can't even begin to imagine.
I hope you don't. I really like wish no one would ever have to go through such a difficult moment. Because it's absolutely like it was the most difficult moment in my life. To miss such a moment with Noor, a moment that we always like planned for, dreamed of. We made like a lot of arrangements like to have it as perfect as possible, you know. But the fact that the administration refused my temporary release request, and also they refused to move me to be closer, like to New Jersey, like to take me back to New Jersey, where, you know, like I can be in a closer facility to Noor. Just shows you like the cruelty of this administration, and it shows you that they wanted to punish me. They wanted to torture me in that sense, and they were not just detaining me like
you think for... you think that was on purpose. You think that they were trying to break you, so, like
all of it, like it was always by design. The fact that, because it's not usual that someone would be taken over 15 miles, 14 miles away from their home to be detained in such a facility. It's not normal at all. Such requests are usually granted, like to be closer to your family. So clearly, like, it was by design. They even refused at one point, like when Noor, after a month of the birth, she visited me. So they refused a contact visit between us, like just to be in the same room where I can hold her hand, hug her, and hold my newborn for the first time. So we had to do it the first time through a glass barrier, and wow. Then we had to get a court order, a federal court order, to allow us to allow me to hold like my son, literally.
What's that moment, Mahmoud? What's that
so
like?
It's all, as I said, like it's all cruelty by design. And that moment, I mean, it's mixed feelings between absolutely being like, you know, elated, so happy to be finally like to hug them and to have Dean in my lab. But at the same time, we only had 1 hour, and it took us, you know, a court order. It took us like 25 lawyers to do that. It took us like so many phone calls the week leading up to it to make it happen. That mixed feeling of rage and anger that we, you know, I'm being deprived such moments with my family just because I said something that the president of this country and the lobby, the Zionist lobby, did not like. These two moments like were so difficult. Just to be on the phone trying to hide your tears from people around you, and it was like, I think, 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. in the morning, so everyone is asleep. So I had to be very quiet, like. Because I really wanted to, as much as possible, like support Noor, like even on the phone, like I wanted like to be able to support her. But I also wasn't able to do so because like I had to speak in a very, low voice, and the phones are very bad. Like the line is, you know, these old like street phones, like. Wow. That you have to shout in order, like, for the person on the other side to hear you. Absolutely, I would never forgive them for that. Like, no matter how forgiving I am, to forgive like the people who deprived me from such a moment for just, you know, saying something they don't like.
And were you aware of what was happening outside of the detention center, the detention facility? Were you aware of the protests that were happening in your name?
I had calls with my lawyers, who also, we needed a court order to have the phone calls with them. So everything was sort of like a fight with the government to get. But I was pretty much like updated on all of that. We had a TV in the cell, so we can see also like some of the news outside.
You know what I found striking or interesting about this is that a lot of the Jewish protesters who took part in the protests supporting you and asking for your release wanted to make sure that they were speaking out, wanted to make sure that it was known that they were there to support you and to call for your release. Even some students at Columbia, Jewish students, spoke out when you were detained, talked about how you actually went out your way to be protective of them and to ensure that they were protected. How was all of that, I guess, landing on you, striking you? How did that all make you feel?
It absolutely felt great, like to have all this support, and that one was one of the things that kept me going while in detention, like dealing with such difficult moments, because like three months and a half is very long in detention, where you're literally just jailed in one place with no I would say the uncertainty of what would happen to you. And then there's that offer on the table where, like, if you want to be deported, like, you'll be released in a matter of days.
Wow.
And just to see that amount of support, like, pouring from people outside, especially from Jewish students and just Jewish protesters as a whole. I also received countless messages or letters from Jewish from Jewish people in the United States, like, being angry with how this administration is weaponizing anti-Semitism in order to achieve its own authoritarian or fascist agenda. And to me, you know, we worked very closely with the Jewish community at Columbia, mm-hmm. and in New York, because we knew that Israel is using the Judaism to achieve its, you know, its colonial goals. And we knew that this administration doesn't care about anti-Semitism. In fact, it is fueling anti-Semitism in this country by, whether, you know, meeting with all these Holocaust deniers, meeting with these conspiracy theorists, and even supporting new Nazi parties across Europe. I think when I was detained, I saw a news article about Rubio being angry with Germany and supporting the AfD, the new Nazi right wing,
far right, yeah.
Far right in Germany, and at the same time, detaining me, claiming that this is happening for combating anti-Semitism. So to me, you know, such groups are the one who are combating anti-Semitism, who are showing the world that what Israel is doing, what this country is doing, has nothing to do with the Jewish people, and they're just weaponizing it in order to achieve their own colonial goals.
If I switch gears for a second and talk about politics, one of the actions that was taken while you were being detained was, there was a letter signed by members of Congress asking for your release. Now, 14 Democrats signed that letter. It included Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. But I look at it and I'm like, 14, that's a low number for a person that captivated, you know, you became basically a fixation for the media, for protests across the country. I don't know. What did you make of that?
So, I mean, just to be fair, there was another letter a day after, I think. It was signed by 100 plus Democrats too. But those also, that doesn't make it any that makes your argument fully the same. Just shows how the Democratic Party is out of touch, they would still prefer to just, you know, appease their AIPAC handler than actually do what's right. I think this trend is changing now, because they now understand that the public is becoming more and more aware of Israeli crimes, is becoming more leaning toward Palestinians. But it's disgraceful that.
But is it changing in terms of as far as the Democrats are concerned, Mahmoud, do you think? Because I think of, for example, there was a recent Pete Buttigieg interview where, you know, he was asked a very clear yes or no question about supplying arms to Israel. And he just gave this very long-winded answer, which wasn't yes or no. It was very much, it sounded like a filibuster. Yeah. But
that's a testament that it's changing, because a year ago or 2 years ago, you would ask him, he would say outright no. You know, that he would still want to to support Israel, and now he's you know he's giving like a two minute answer just to avoid saying yes or no. But I believe that, like, you know, what happened recently in New York with the election of Mondan. Not the primary election of Zohran,
yep.
is a testament, but also like the just recently, I think the majority of Democrat senators are sponsoring a bill to block arms sale to Israel, and that did not, you know, that's something very new. So the change is happening, but it's very slow, and we need to call them out. Like, it's not that, like, you know, like it's that's perfect, and we need to continue doing that. And unless they feel that there is a price to pay, which is their election, they wouldn't, because most of them, they only care about being elected another time. There's a good portion of them who, you know, now are becoming like more and more aware of the extent that Israel would go with its crimes against Palestinians, the starvation and all of that, and they can't hide. Because in the past it was like, you know, if I don't look at it, like, it doesn't exist, you know. But now it's becoming in their faces. So there's that change. And I sensed that when I visited D.C. A couple of weeks ago, when I met about, a dozen lawmakers there. And you can sense that the policy around Palestine and just the narrative around Palestine in Congress is shifting. Like, people are now,
but
they feel that.
Is it a case? Sorry, Mahmoud, I don't mean to cut you off, but is it a case of saying, because we've heard others also express similar sentiment, is it a case of politicians basically saying, you know, we fully agree with you, we stand with you, we support you, we support the Palestinians, we want to end this, we want to end the bloodshed, but also go on and tweet something completely different, or go on and vote for...
There's a lot of that. Yeah, I was surprised bill. Like by how some of them were very vocal in private, and then you see their public stance, it's not as vocal. But at least, you know, like, now it's Palestine is no longer, I would say, like, that issue that they would feel they can't talk about or they can't stand for. But it's baby steps. This is in no way that I'm you know, like, the illusion of that, like, oh, they're becoming pro-Palestine and all of that. It's baby steps. That's why people should continue to push to push change in this country. And I believe it is happening. Unfortunately, like, Muhammad, you know, like, institutions, especially elected institutions, are the last to respond to change on the ground. It takes time. And we have to be realistic about that. And unfortunately, I wouldn't say, like, this is good news, because the people are still being starved. The people are still being killed. Yeah. This wouldn't mean anything to someone on the ground who's being, you know, attacked by settlers or being starved in Gaza. But that's just like my political reading of how the political, like, sphere is changing in the United States. And we'll see. I mean, the primary, the midterms are in a year.
I got a couple last questions before I let you go. Even though I'm really enjoying the conversation, I don't want it to end, Mahmoud. But I do want to get a question in about the media, because mm-hmm. here's what struck me. So after you're out on bail right now, and so after your release, you did a round of interviews. You went on mainstream media outlets. And still, you know, you describe what happened to you as a kidnapping, and that's what others have called it as well, the way that you were taken in and arrested and detained. And yet you just get released, you go on these different outlets, you go on these shows, and it almost like, again, and this is something that we touched on about being this perfect Palestinian, let's say, or this Palestinian that checks all of the boxes required of you in order for the conversation to proceed. So then you go on the media channels and you have to go through the list of condemnations before you kind of become a person again. And I look at you and I see you and I'm like, oh, okay, as long as you did all of this, now I can humanize you and have a conversation with you. And in spite of the fact that you were very clear about where you stand, you know, you were against the killing of innocent civilians. You've said it very clearly. Yet it doesn't stick. It has to go through a certain checklist. How has your experience with the media been?
You summarized it very, very well, and such distortion of my words, like in the media, is just very pathetic and pity. Like, they just wanted to find anything, and that goes to what I told you. Like, they wouldn't be they wouldn't accept you, like, no matter what you said. Like, even if I say yes to any of these questions, like, no, they wouldn't stop there. They would still go beyond that to discredit me because I'm Palestinian, because I'm advocating for Palestinian rights, and let's be clear, like, this the smear and the distortion is just an attempt to distract from the fact that I am targeted for my lawful speech, that I was unlawfully detained for over 100 days, that I missed the birth of my child because of them. And also it's meant to deflect from the reality that Israel has killed over like 62,000 Palestinians and is carrying out a genocide in Gaza, and backed by the U.S. Taxpayer money. And that's how I take, like, such attempts. It's just like distortion, deflection, like, let's not talk about Palestine, let's like demonize the movement, so that, like, you're discredited, you're not talking, no one would hear about what really matters, which is Palestine. Because, you know, like, both you and I, we spent like an hour just talking about my detention and the conditions, and very little, like, you know, like, about Palestine. But, like, that's what they want. Like, they want, like, just for us to spend that time there and not talk about Palestine. For me, like, you know, as I said, like, as you said, like, I did a round of interviews with mainstream media because I also want to tell my story myself, to force them to listen to Palestinian voices, even if they are. Even I know, like, for a fact that a lot of them, you know, like, they make an effort to ask such dehumanizing, because to me these are all dehumanizing questions. Like, they are designed to dehumanize you. They are designed to put you, like, in a certain
to
category.
Other you as well. Yeah,
exactly. So and that's why, like, I want to continue challenge that in their media, because that should happen. And now I believe, like, a lot of viewers around the United States are becoming more and more aware of that, because there has been a lot of pushback against such questions, against such media from different people. But the media is nasty. It's very nasty here. Like, they literally manufactured consent for the whole genocide that's now taking place in Gaza. But at least now we can push back and go against, like, the current of this hateful media against Palestinians.
Mahmoud, my last question before we sign off. You're currently suing the government for $20 million. You have an ongoing case with the Trump administration. But what I want to ask you right now is, how do you think Americans will look back on this moment years from now?
Oh, they would look at it in disgrace, to be honest. Such things are happening under their watch. They can't say that we don't know, because now they know. They know that their country is fully supporting a genocide against Palestinians using their dollars, their tax money. But this is why I wanna keep fighting, because I don't want in a few years, or in, I don't know in how many years, to have a museum for Palestinians or a museum for the U.S. involvement. No, I actually want to challenge what's happening in the present day and to avoid such unfortunate future if we don't continue fighting. But absolutely, that what's happening is very disgraceful, not only on the Palestine front, but also on the immigration front, where you have in a lot of places like these detention centers where people don't have any rights, where people are being called names and being dehumanized, being not afforded any sort of constitutional protections that this country fought for, in the past, or the founders of this country, I would say. But we need to continue fighting to actually not reach a point where talk about Palestinians in the past tense or in a museum or so.
And on that note, we'll leave it here. Mahmoud Khalil, I can't thank you enough for taking so much time from your day, given everything that you have going on, given the responsibilities you have at home, to come on Real Talk and speak to me.
Thank you so much, Mohammed. Really, really appreciated the conversation with you and enjoyed it.
No, I appreciate it, Mahmoud. Thank you for your time.